With me now is Chef Marcus Samuelson, the owner of multiple restaurants, including, as you probably guessed, Red Rooster, which is located in Harlem. His newest cookbook, The Red Rooster Cookbook, The Story of Food and Hustle in Harlem, is filled with beautifully photographed recipes from Red Rooster, as well as illustrations, short essays from Marcus and figures in the Harlem community, and playlists that go with each chapter. If Harlem were a person, this cookbook could arguably be its memoir. I'm so pleased to welcome Marcus Samuelson to the show. Welcome. It's so great to see you.
Thank you for having me, Melissa. This is wonderful.
So you've been, it's been 7 years since you opened Red Rooster. How are you feeling about it?
I feel great. And I feel like, you know, I feel it's 15 years because it took 7 years to plan and 7 years, you know, we've been open. But it's also how the community has evolved. And we, as a restaurant in general, you kind of feel like, okay, what's our big task this year? How can we evolve? And this year, I feel it's going back to craftsmanship.
Mm.
You know, it's just one of these, in each department, we can own that so differently.
Yeah.
And so I'm excited. In general, I'm always excited, like, okay, let's go.
So this is your 2017 goal?
Yep. Craftsmanship.
Let's talk a little bit about how you started, how you opened the restaurant. You were coming from Aquavit, very fine dining. What made you want to leave Midtown and open a restaurant in Harlem that was a whole other experience, a whole other type of cuisine and a whole other type of restaurant?
Sure. Well, it's, I always pride myself in having some intellectual undertone in the food, in the messaging, right? My father was a geologist, and he always worked with me and us, all the kids, on this, what's your overall message? And I just felt that the intellectual conversation didn't have to compromise the deliciousness.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes when you cook really, really, really high-end food, I felt sometimes the deliciousness was compromised. And I think also, quite frankly, I look at my career pre-9/11 and post-9/11, very, very different. You know, being at the Towers a week before and just, you know, working with Chef Mike LaMonaco and knowing a lot of those, the staff that passed, it was a personal crisis for me. Like, I was like, I can't just stay here and continue and cook. And I started to ask myself a lot of questions. And out of that came the fact that I moved to Harlem. It took years to sort of develop, okay, what am I doing here besides just cooking for the 1% of the 1%?
Mm-hmm.
And my mother, on the other ear, talking to me like, why are you so committed to only cook for bankers? How do you know that their taste is just better? And I didn't grow up that way.
Right.
And she said, also, why don't you just cook in the community where you live? And that's those things colliding, the fact that fine dining, post-9/11, changed. I don't think it got better or worse. It's just changed. And then me going through this sort of personal thing about challenging maybe cooking in the community I lived.
Now, you grew up in Sweden. So how large was Harlem in your consciousness when you were a child? And what made you decide to move there when you came to New York?
Well, you know, having grown up, being the black kids on the block, grown up with the white parents, holding on to black content and black culture was something that, you know, we didn't have, you know, African-American uncles or aunties, right? So giving us culture was very much music or storytelling, and whether it was books or whether it was movies or whether it was through music. And then Harlem was very often the capital of that, right? So it was something, it was more a learning center, but it was also a place that constantly showed up, whether it was through Alex Haley book, or whether it was through a Maya Angelou book, or whether it was through a movie, quite frankly. Harlem became the epic center for black culture for us, and it was a place for my parents to sort of like talk about as a place that neither of them actually had experienced.
Had they ever been?
Now they've been.
Of course, now they've been.
But back then, no. But it was more like my father was like, in Harlem, at the Apollo, this happened, you know? And so it was a place that we sort of thought about and held up. And I've actually spoken to other kids that grew up there, are African place, but maybe grew up in Germany or grew up in England. Harlem has always been that place to them, a place of aspirations.
And so when you moved there, did it meet your expectations? Was it very different from what you were thinking?
That's a good question. I think it was a little bit of both. And I realized that, which I thought was fascinating, that when I started cooking, I went to France, it was a linear way of getting great information. You go to the best chefs and you got the best information and off you go. But when I was traveling and ate street food in Singapore or street food in Japan, those flavors were something that I really loved, but they were not in restaurants. And Harlem was the same. Harlem had great food, great storytellers, great music, but not necessarily in restaurants and not necessarily in traditional venues. You could be invited to someone's house, fantastic food, fantastic music. You could go to an art exhibit in a basement after church. So all these things that we think about as culture and restaurants or content were all over Harlem, but they were not in traditional venues. And that was something that I needed almost to translate that in a while. And for me, I was so focused on opening a restaurant, but I realized it took me 6 years. I have to do a restaurant that matches the energy of Harlem, but my inspiration cannot be traditional restaurants. It has to come from the park. It has to come from the vendors outside the Apollo. And then I have to sort of translate that into flavors that then becomes the restaurant. So and that was different for me, Melissa.
So part of the journey, part of the reason it took 6 years is because you really had to uncover that and explore and find out exactly what Harlem was about so that you could then...
Yes, absolutely. And this is incredible photographer David Bay that he documented Harlem for 3 years before he really even thought of himself as a photographer. But because what he was taught in photography school was very different than he found on the streets of Harlem, right? It's almost like you hear great drum beat, but here on the streets, you don't really know how to value that, right? So it was that translation that took me years to figure out. And obviously, what part of the skills that I've trained in Midtown and in France could I bring with me? And what part did I just have to say, not here, not now, doesn't fit?
I've been speaking with James Beard award-winning chef Marcus Samuelson. His latest book is The Red Rooster Cookbook. And so when you were putting together the menu for Red Rooster, so that was something you wanted to keep your personal, the foods of that you grew up with.
Yeah.
And you also wanted to take in all the flavors that you were trying. But there were some other influences, too. Can you just talk about how you created the menu?
Well, there's a lot of immigrants in Harlem that has been there but doesn't always get acknowledged. For example, there's always been a strong Chinese culture. So we had to sort of have a nod at that. We've gone from this Latin community El Barrio that was traditionally Puerto Rican, but today is Mexican, for example. So we had to sort of go from, you know, really think about tacos, tortillas in a completely different way. But it really had its roots in pernil and crazy good sort of, you went from salsa to mariachi band in, but you know, how did that taste like? Italian-American on the east side, right? Don't forget, Harlem is the place that produced both Rao's and Patsy's, right? And then strong Jewish notes in certain parts and pockets of Harlem. So having all this come alive, making it a map without sort of putting addresses to it. And so all of that immigrant culture was important for me to represent. Of course, Harlem is known for the foods of the Great Migration. So I would say 50% is that. And 50% is these other pockets that may be a little bit lesser known.
What are some examples then of some dishes that kind of...
Well, it comes in many ways. In our programming, we have a Latin night. So then in our little nook, we have always a Latin chef that takes over and he or she does specials from that. It could be anything from arepas, tortillas to ceviches, for example. And then if you think about... There's also been Italian-American community, so we will always have a pasta dish on. Right now we make these barley dumplings with lamb neck that has very much Italian-American notes to it, but they read more like Aunt Mabel's dumplings, so it has a tonality to it. You really got to discover them because the Italian-American community had been in Harlem for a very, very long time. I read this incredible book, story about how there was a restaurant right across the street from Red Rooster, where it's right now. 100 years ago, there was an Italian-American restaurant called Bell. And, you know, it was very important there. You know, just studying, you find pockets of immigrants that came to Harlem in many, many, many times where you maybe didn't think that it was happening there.
How important is, you're using a lot of musical analogies, how important is music to what you guys do at Red Rooster? I mean, it's half of it, isn't it?
Or? Yeah, I mean, I think that the staff, I always think about it, is the core of what we do, and then our customers. But the art and the music is just as much part of the four-wall experience as salt and peppers, as chicken and pork, because the music is there to inform the consumer about the experience in a completely different way than I've worked before, and so is the art. So we couldn't be the Rooster without the musicians.
And tell me about the original Red Rooster. So there was an original restaurant, right?
Yeah, there was a time in Central Harlem was more on 138, 135th Street, where the YMCA is today, and close to the Abyssinia. So Red Rooster was on this tiny little restaurant row between 137th and 138th on 7th Avenue, which is called Adam Clayton Avenue. And one of the reasons why I loved Red Rooster was because it was a tiny bar that, first of all, it was gay-friendly. And I was just inspired by the open-mindedness of that, right, in the 40s. Then it was also a place where both the celebrity could come, the politician, Adam Clayton Powell, a young Charlotte Rangel, but also the maid and the post office worker. Also, it was racially for everybody, which a lot of these famous places like Cotton Club and so on, of course, black people were allowed to work in those places, but not to come as customers. So it was a very tiny place, but large in its idea, and I loved that.
And that was an inspiration, I think, because you're also, I mean, I know that's very important for you to have the mixing of clientele. Did you find that you had trouble getting your customers from Midtown to come up to Harlem?
Well, I think finding the balance, Melissa, is anything when you start an endeavor like that. It's just an idea, and then it's what do you do with it. But, you know, it was also an opportunity to be very honest about this dialogue and your successes and your failures, right? The first week, we were packed. But I was like, wait a minute. It was only with people that made reservations. And I spoke to some of my local clientele, and they were like, well, I thought you built a restaurant for us, but we're in Harlem. We're not making reservations to our local restaurant. And that was just small indications like that. Like, okay, I have to change it. So ever since that, 30% of the restaurant you can never book because it's open for walk-ins only. And, you know, I was nervous. We just took out a big loan on the restaurant. We were a new restaurant. We needed to be really busy right away. But to trust the community and say, hey, this is yours. You don't have to make a reservation. Come as you want. That wink and be open with that and be open with the failure of like, okay, we shouldn't have done that. I apologize. So I think through social media and through also staying connected through the community, there is so many ways today to actually say, hey, that worked, that didn't, shame on us, we will do better. And that was different from when I was cooking before. It was always like, here we are, here's the grand opening, everything is working. Of course it wasn't.
Right.
But it was a different front. And you just, Harlem taught me to put this front somewhere else. It doesn't work.
And what else have there been other lessons that you've learned from the neighborhood?
Absolutely. I think also that learning to evolve, like Red Rooster is not a bus stop because we become, you know, a vintage and sort of part destination, part local. But that doesn't allow us just to take the customer for granted. So this is something that we constantly work on. Like, for example, putting Lana Turner's, you know, a commitment to her 40 years of how she dressed. I call Lana Turner our Anna Wintour. So constantly use the space as an incubator for young and local talent that is their restaurant as well. That the cooking classes is not for just for the highest bidder, but can also be for free for the community. So constantly have a dialogue. And, you know, I travel a lot, so I can bring with me what I see on the road and upload it in the restaurant. That is something that the community has appreciated the most.
Now, I know that you do most of your hiring from the community. Yeah. Has that affected the relationship with your diners as well?
Sure. I mean, the key for us is not to be more than a restaurant and not to be a logistically traditional restaurant, right? And be a leaning endeavor. But how much, right? So it was always this, I want our service to know a full wine list and a wine list. But at the same time, this balance between, I want them also to have local knowledge and know-how, right? So this balance between just pure restaurant know-how versus, hey, once you're done, Melissa, there is a beautiful bar two blocks away from here. So this local knowledge didn't necessarily have to be mutually exclusive. So we can train the restaurant knowledge, but the local knowledge it's very hard to train and finding these jewels, right? So constantly have this balance between traditional hospitality know-how versus local knowledge. And it's, again, it's not something that you can just take for granted. You have to work on and practice on every day.
Now, I think probably when people go to your restaurant, do you get assumptions when they walk in? Do they think, oh, this is going to be soul food only? Are they surprised at the diversity of the menu?
I think that happens constantly. I think there's a couple of conversations that happens, and they happen probably differently now than when we go beginning. It's like, oh, how cool, we're going to Harlem. Oh, is it safe? Yes, it is. Oh, why? What's going to happen? Is it going to be soul food? And I always say, yes, it will be cooked with a lot of soul. There's a difference there. So, but isn't that also part of going out, is that you want to trust something, but you don't fully want to know what it is. You want this level of mystique. Part of the reason why you go out in New York is that you trust it, but you don't know fully what you're going to get. And that's part of going out.
We've been speaking with Marcus Samuelson, the author of The Red Rooster Cookbook, The Story of Food and Hustle in Harlem. You can find Marcus's recipes for Sunday tomato eggs and steam bass, fiery noodles with long beans on our show page. Marcus, thank you so much for coming into our talking to us on the show.
Happy New Year, and thank you for having me.